Hey folks, welcome back to The Ferment. It's been a while. A lot of things have happened since our last episodes. Alana's gone on to do some really amazing work in kind of diving into the deeps of her ancestry and the spirituality of her ancestors, the language of her ancestors. She's doing a folk opera. Some really cool stuff. I encourage you to look her up and check her out. I've been to school, and I just convocated this last Friday, actually, with a master's in marriage and family therapy, and grateful to have done that. Grateful to have some time for some other things again, including some time at least for this this podcast project. I'm firing the ferment up for a couple reasons. One is it's been my privilege to be part of some conversations with David Cayley and two other Illichians. Really a few other Illichians, but two others who have written some books, Sam Ewell and Dugald Hine. Very helpful work that they've put into the world. And together with UK singer-songwriter David Benjamin Blower, we've been hosting some conversations that we're happy to share with you on this podcast venue. And then the other thing is, my heart is heavy with all the wars, and so I almost finished putting together my audiobook some time ago, and then never kind of figured out how to package it as an audiobook per se. So I think I'm just gonna be releasing the chapters free as podcast episodes here. It just if I look at the back cover of my book, boy, this just seems truer now than it was when the book came out. Our present moment can no longer sustain a stable us versus an alien them, according to René Girard and Ivan Illich, radical critics of both Christianity and culture. The end of us versus them can deteriorate into the chaos of each against each, or it can open outward into freely chosen communion. It is an expectant and apocalyptic time. How does one live in this strange end time world? It just, when I witness some of what's happening in Ukraine and Palestine, Gaza and Israel, it just feels like we're in a place where, you know, we're just Christian enough to not silence victims, even if they are on the other side of our conflict, at least not completely. And so the outrage can spread, but we're not really Christian enough to renounce the violent passions that drive us towards escalation, that the scapegoat mechanism used to give us an out for. That was fairly effective for many years until the revelation of the cross really, really exposed that devil's machine for what it is. It seems like a good time to come out with chapters of life at the end of us versus them. So I'll be there'll be kind of a mix for the next little while of episodes that'll be chapters from the book. And episodes that will be full audio from some really exciting Zoom conversations with David Cayley and Sam Ewell and Dugald Hine, hosted by myself and David Benjamin Blower. So for now, without further ado, I'm happy to give you some introductory bits of the book, and then right into the first chapter, The Religion of the End of Religion, chapter 1 from Life at the End of Us versus Them. Peace and all good.
Any classical text would show friendship presupposes an ethnos, a given here and now to which I belong by birth. Then comes that major disturber and fool, that historical Jesus of the Gospels, with his story about the Samaritan, the Palestinian who is the only one who acts as a friend towards the beaten-up Jew. Jesus disrupted the frame that limited the conditions under which friendship could appear. Ivan Illich. The apocalypse is not some invention. It's, if we are without sacrifices, either we are going to love each other or we're going to die. We have no more protection against our own violence. Therefore, we are confronted with it. Either we are going to follow the rules of the kingdom of God, or the situation is going to get infinitely worse. René Girard. Prologue. Traditional cultures subsisted on sunshine, which was captured mostly through agriculture. The hoe, the ditch, the yoke were basic means to harness the sun. Language was drawn by each one from the cultural environment, learned from the encounter with people whom the learner could smell and touch, love or hate. Just as fuel was not delivered, so the vernacular was never taught. Ivan Illich. Covering mile after mile of interstate, from Comer, Georgia to Pembina, North Dakota, in 3 days, I contemplate our collapse. We can't go on like this. Any assurance otherwise is a lie. We pass one billboard that promises energy security in terms of corn. Another offers peace of mind through insurance policy. But the underground explosives of the boys fracking oil at Williston sound the rumbling scrape of America hitting the bottom of its barrel. Yet even still, fuel is cheap. We can travel 800 kilometers for $50, a mere hour of work for some, including my wife Jen. Collectively, the human race continues to burn through 84 million barrels of oil every day. When we get home, after burning through 400 liters of diesel, I set fire to the carbon of trees to warm our little house, and know this act of resistance to be entirely symbolic. Though it may heal my imagination, no small thing, it will not heal the land. It will not stop humanity from burning through a billion-year inheritance in a century. It will not halt catastrophic climate changes. We are too far gone. My friend and neighbor Victor Robertson calls it the Wile E. Coyote moment. Already off the edge of the cliff, peddling air, held aloft by an illusion. It hurts to talk about this. I understand the draw of denial. Yet if anything, I am praying for the moment of truth to come. The prophets of old were those who saw pain on the horizon, but also the healing born of repentance, the possibility of hearts of flesh replacing hearts of stone. My heart has been made tender by an apocalyptic seer who, instead of preparing his disciples to circle the wagons at the end of the world as they knew it, told them to risk love, to hope rather than to fear, to give away assets rather than to hoard, to receive a peace not as the world gives. I am taken with a prophet who blessed the meek, the little people, the vulnerable ones, promising them, "You shall inherit the earth." I am hardly one of the meek. Woe to you who are rich, strikes much nearer the mark. But, Lord, I want to be a Christian. And so, in this wood-heated home, Jen and I and our two girls are trying to live a life that is small in its beauty and honest in its smallness, and also honest about its impurities. The other day, Jen brought home a loaf of unsliced dry bread from the dumpster at the local co-op. Yes, we dumpster dive. We like free, effortless food. It's a nice contrast to our labor-intensive staples, and the waste distresses us. This makes me want to eat a Reuben sandwich, she said. Yeah, let's have Reubens, said the girls. Buy some pastrami when you're in town, Dad, said Johanna. But we have so much meat of our own in the freezer, I said. Couldn't you make a farmer sausage, Reuben? I want to eat the meat of depressed animals, Johanna said. I bought the pastrami. The next day, we made Reubens with pastrami and Swiss cheese from the store, pumpernickel rye from the dumpster, sauerkraut I had made out of cabbage that we grew, grilled with home-rendered pork lard on the wood stove, fired by deadfall timber that I cut with a gas-powered chainsaw here on our crazy little bend in the Broken Head River in South St. Owens, Manitoba. We washed it down with House of Mandela wine, bartered to us by our itinerant doctor friend, whom we house and feed at the farm when he does his weekend rotation at our local rural hospital. The mood around the table in our little goon shack, as the girls call it, was festive. It was a funny kind of meal, and we are a funny kind of family. Whatever we are not purists. I'm mostly glad about this. It safeguards for us the great joy of laughing at ourselves. Haltingly, inconsistently, we are learning to grow the food we eat and eat the food we grow. Not, I hope, out of the self-consciousness of hipsters, nor out of the fear of preppers, but out of the love of sinners, repentant and seeking after the kingdom of heaven. It is a life that does not offer solutions, but hopes to be a sign. I have learned that when plants put roots into the soil, their roots do not simply suck water and nutrients out. They share. They build community. They put out sugars, proteins, and carbohydrates, cakes and cookies, that gather and feed a communion of microfauna, whose activities hold and return nutrients that the plants themselves cannot make, at just the rate and amount that they require. The most important thing in good soil is not nutrition, but biology. Or, to say the same thing, the richness known to plants is not an abundance of stuff, but an abundance of relationship. We are trying to put down roots in this place, complex, communing roots, rather than simple, consuming ones. We are trying to live in a place, or should I say, in a place that is trying to become a place. Plowshares Community Farm, as elusive as it remains to pin down with a narrative or a meaning, is becoming a place. A place where some families choose to share land, grow food, build homes cooperatively, or at least somewhat more cooperatively than the placeless, atomizing culture around us. And in this place, I tend work that gives me time and space to think and write. My thoughts reach far away, to America, to the wide, wide world, to people I love, to problems I fear, to minds I admire. But they branch out from this place. They are rooted here, nourished by the people, creatures, land, and stories of this place. Without this place, this book would not be. An introduction. Because in most societies, the fraternal relationship implies only a minimum of differences. It obviously constitutes a vulnerable point in a system structured on differences. René Girard. My pacifist Mennonite parents tell me that they named me for the gospel writer Mark. Now, the Mennonites threw out some beautiful babies, art, liturgy, memory of the saints, with the high church bathwater during the Radical Reformation. But one thing they got right was that any serious reading of Jesus' Sermon on the Mount leads to a refusal of war. While I never had any natural disposition for loving my enemies, it was never hard for me to see that any Christian justification of war was sheer nonsense. The rest of my name comes from having a father named Peter Rempel, along with an uncle and a grandfather named Peter Rempel, both on my mother's side. Somewhere in my family line, there are probably some non-Mennonites with more original names, but they are too far back for any of us to remember. I've learned that the literal meaning of Marcus is son of Mars, the Roman god of war. When I look into my heart, this also feels apt. For like many peace activists, I have often taken the Christian love for the poor and the stranger as convenient grounds to hate the rich and the established, the man, as we like to say. For as long as I can remember, I've had a recurring dream of being chased by an aggressor. In the end, I am always cornered, and I end up killing my enemy in some gruesome way. When I was still a boy and living at home with my family, this dream often included my younger brother, and I had to protect him from the aggressor. Sometimes I'd defeat the bad man, and something ugly and violent would happen to him. But sometimes I would fail, and something ugly and violent would happen to my little brother. My brother's name is Daniel Jacob Rempel. Jacob Rempel comes from my dad's dad, a fastidious and gentle man known to his colleagues as Jake the Ruler, a draftsman with a love for order and precision. My brother has been an excellent namesake, a mighty evangelist for lean principles of workflow management, and the proud owner of more measuring tapes than anybody else I know. Daniel's first name means lover of God, though he is known now to all but his immediate family as Dan, having deliberately dropped the Hebrew El signifier for God. Like Daniel, who stood alone in the lion's den for refusing to worship King Darius, my brother took his namesake stance against idolatry one more step, from a committed monotheism to a committed atheism. He got there by being a careful student of science and by accepting with tremendous intellectual courage and discipline the implications of Occam's razor. The simplest explanation for things is always the best. Like Daniel, I have had a lifelong fondness for science, and I admire his pursuit towards the most honest accounting of our surroundings. That certainly has brought about many doubts and much rethinking of my Christian faith, but it was never really enough to do away with the whole package. Not least, I think, because for me the essential questions of Christianity were not about how to explain stuff, but about the problem of human violence, to which the New Testament poses the cross as an answer. An answer I always found as puzzling as I found it compelling. Along this road, I have found two guides who have been very helpful to me, each one of them a scientist of sorts. René Girard, an anthropologist with a keen interest in ancient literature, and Ivan Illich, quote, an archaeologist of ideas. Both of these document how Christianity has changed the course of history, for good and for evil. In these essays, I explore the meaning and the impact of the cross, not first of all theologically, but anthropologically. I'm wrestling with what the cross tells us about who people are and how it has changed our world, whether we believe in it or not. Along the way, the cross holds some surprising implications for who God is. But my brother, quite rightly, has taught me to be shy of speaking too much about the divine mystery of which I know so little. In many ways, I've come to regard his atheism as God's gift to me. For without his thoughtful, disciplined atheism to contend with, I suspect my Christianity would have remained a lot more thoughtless and undisciplined. One can never wrestle enough with God, as Simone Weil says. This too evokes my brother's name. Jacob is the biblical figure who wrestles with the angel of the Lord and prevails, walking away from the fight with a lifelong limp. Weil's blessing goes on. Christ likes us to prefer truth to him, because before being Christ, he is truth. Still, the basic disagreement between my brother and I remains. I put it this way: is the existential crisis of our age that we have to learn to live without God or without violence? I argue for the latter, and on this point I don't see a lot of wiggle room for a creature that has invented the atom bomb, to name only one avenue for cataclysm on that wide road that leads to our destruction. Though I find more common ground philosophically with an atheist committed to nonviolence than with a theist committed to violence, I am skeptical that a life of nonviolence can be attained without a connection to the transcendent. For violent solutions remain deliriously seductive, even for those who believe that we are not alone and that death is not the final word. War, as Chris Hedges says, is a force that gives us meaning. I cannot see how to resist violence without experiencing another force, drinking in another meaning. Recently, I dreamt that a large man was chasing me around an apartment, continually cornering me, insisting on a fight. When he followed me into the bathroom, I told him that he could hit me, but that I would not fight him. He sent tremendous blows, skimming just past the tip of my nose over and over again, as if he needed to prove that he really could hurt me. Well, I needed to show that I really would let him. But I was scared, and I closed my eyes, and then I lost my balance. Reaching forward, I caught hold of his other hand with a couple of fingers, then my whole hand. Suddenly we were holding hands, embracing and weeping. When I woke up, I thought, I finally had a pacifist dream. I've had peace theology all my life. I've also felt the God of war and the Prince of Peace vying with one another in both my name and in my blood, in my waking as well as my dreaming. Conversion is not a moment in life. It is a lifelong journey. There is no road to peace, as Gandhi said. Peace is the road.
Chapter 1. The Religion of the End of Religion. Christianity is not only one of the destroyed religions, but it is the destroyer of all religions. The death of God is a Christian phenomenon. René Girard. Christianity is a strange beast. At its center is an ugly, naked image, an innocent torture victim,
pinned like an insect onto two intersecting beams of wood. What is Jesus doing there? My mom tells me that I asked about this when I was very young. Mom knew the standard answers, of course, but could not bring herself to tell her perplexed preschooler that Jesus had to die to pay for his sins. I was too young to have gotten much sinning done by that point in my life, and the idea that someone else would have to have been killed preemptively to make me right with God 2,000 years later, well, she knew there was no way to tell me that without some emotional and intellectual collateral damage. Instead, she told me that God loved people so much that he became a person who let himself be killed by people to show them that even if they did such a terrible thing, God would still love them. This was still a very strange tale, but it drew me. Christians have been trying to make sense of Jesus' cross for a long time. It stunned his disciples. It confounded the early church. The Apostle Paul strained the limits of language reaching for these words. For Jews demand signs and Greeks desire wisdom. But we proclaim Christ crucified, a scandal to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles. For God's foolishness is wiser than human wisdom, and God's weakness is stronger than human strength. End quote. On this much Christians have agreed from the beginning. The foolish weakness of this God-man willingly going to the cross was somehow a gift of love for the whole world, a saving act. How so? Kicking that question around has been the oddball game of Christian theologians for two millennia. For the past 1700 years of Christendom, when Christianity was still an official religion for Westerners, this game may have been impenetrable to most of us, but it mattered nonetheless, since we still treated our theologians as the professors who wrote the entrance exams for heaven. Those days are done. A fair expectation today would be to relegate the meaning of Jesus' cross with other quaint antiquities, like how to read and treat bilious humors, or what sort of monsters and waterworks one should expect to find at the edge of a flat earth. And yet, cross-shaped stories are everywhere today, by which I mean stories of innocent victims harmed by suspect authority figures. Unarmed black men shot to death by white cops south of the border. Or here, in a gunless Canadian parallel, a confused immigrant in the Vancouver airport tasered to death by the RCMP for threatening public safety with a stapler. Political staffers sexually harassed by Canadian MPs. Young dates choked by a CBC radio star. Students abused by teachers. Children abused by parents, women abused by men. Not long ago, the news reported the death of Lina Hart, a prominent activist and elder in Winnipeg's Indigenous community. Many came to know Lina's story through the National Film Board's documentary, We Were Children, about a church-run Indian residential school system. At a young age, Lina was raped by a Christian priest in one of those schools. Her story is one of thousands like it. It can be taken to attest to the total bankruptcy of Christianity in our time. As a religion and as an institution, there is a lot to that. But as for the message of Jesus, I'm hearing it louder and clearer every day. Whatsoever you have done unto the least of these, Nietzsche was right about this much. Christianity is a religion of slaves, the losers, the outcasts, and the crucified. My mother intuited something in her simple explanation of the cross that many great theologians before her were not yet ready to see, that the violence of the crucifixion was not a sacred violence demanded by heaven for the good of all. the violence was demanded by the mob. The Gospels are remarkably clear on this, considering how long we have insisted on implicating heaven in the collective murder. According to them, the victim was offered by heaven as an act of love to fulfill a sacrifice that was required not by a violent God, but by corrupt authorities who needed a scapegoat to appease a violent humanity. To borrow some language from the New Testament, there is good news when the cross meets culture, but there is also apocalypse. The cross holds out a dangerous revelation that disrupts the common peace. The, quote, piecemeal poor peace that we have known so far has hung on our ability to see the makers of culture, the policeman, the priest, and the politician, as somehow above us, and the hurts they commit not as unjust, but as somehow necessary, or at the very least necessary to keep out of view, to protect the respect of their office. We have had to believe that their violence was draped in a mantle of sacred duty that distinguished it from the violence the rest of us are prone to see it as a violence committed for the good of all. Yet seen from the underside, through the eyes of the victims, those powers we rely on to keep this peace start looking an awful lot like thugs. The noble cause of king and country looks like a dressed-up protection racket. This is a big problem for good governance. It is the reason other regimes do not allow a free press. There is a strange irony in our age. In the grand scope of history, our leaders are more accountable, more sensitive to public rebuke, less above the law than in any other epoch, yet we are more openly cynical of our politicians as incorrigible scoundrels than any previous citizenry. Pulling back the veil from authorities' abuses, the very thing that makes our leaders more honest, has made us more jaded. A God who knows no violence towards humankind signals a startling and difficult departure from our old gods, the ones we have depended upon for so long to prop up our violent stabilities. Without them, our politics become nothing more than a manifestation of the will to power. This is the void Nietzsche saw approaching and tried to bless. He went mad. Today that Nietzschean madness rears its bronzed, hairsprayed head in the overman figure of Donald Trump. Nietzsche at least had the intelligence and the decency to identify himself clearly over against Christianity. The fact that Trump could garner the endorsement of prominent church leaders shows just how far into madness we can descend, and how urgent the need is in our time to figure out what in the world Christianity is and isn't. Perhaps in this strange time, our choices come down to choosing between different kinds of crazy. Over the last 2 decades, I have become a disciple of 2 crazies. The first of these madmen, a mad scientist, actually, is one who has substantiated and expanded on my mother's intuitive instruction on Jesus' death. Quote, "Only a madman or a crackpot, disregarding all the conventions of scholarship in the humanities and the social sciences, could make the following outrageous claims today. That the history of humanity, considered in its entirety and in spite, or rather because, of its sound and fury, has a meaning. That this meaning is accessible to us. And that although a science of mankind now exists, it is not mankind that made it. That this science was given to mankind by divine revelation. That the truth of mankind is religious in nature. That madman is René Girard." End quote. I fear a summary such as this could send non-religious friends scurrying for the exits. Perhaps I can coax them on with a quotation from a reviewer of Girard's Violence and the Sacred, who celebrated it as a great and unique achievement, quote, because it gives us at last the first authentically atheistic theory of religion and of the sacred, end quote. For disciples of Girard, the juxtaposition of both these reviews signals the startling breakthrough that Girard achieves. The breakthrough most academics have condemned as an impossibility, but which so many thoughtful believers have been waiting for. A rational social science that forms a, quote, seamless garment with Christ-centered theology. Girard is more deeply critical of religion than my atheist friends, while he is at the same time more orthodox than many of my Christian friends. Compared to Girard, Dennett, Dawkins, Harris, and other atheists are only tinkering around the edges in their deconstruction of religion. Dennett, for example, diagnoses religion as a result of hyperactive agency detection disorder, an early and ongoing human tendency to ascribe volition and being to phenomena that they cannot otherwise explain, weather, disease, the appearance or disappearance of prey, phenomena that science can now clear up. Instead of trifling with these externals, Girard cuts to the heart of human culture, where his analysis is far more devastating. Religion is deeply complicit in legitimating the necessary evils that hold the social order together, sanctifying the machinery of death and expulsion that draws the arbitrary line between good and evil, us and them. Dennett's work can piss off lazy thinkers, but threatens little else. Girard's deconstruction shakes our foundations. First of all, because he recognizes religion as absolutely foundational, which Dawkins and Dennett dare not, and secondly, because he recognizes that foundation as murderous. These are the kind of revelations likely to get their originator crucified, which, of course, was exactly their result the first time around. For Girard is clear that the light his interpretive work has shone on human religion and culture did not begin with him. That light has been shining in our darkness for some time. Girard makes the odd claim that Christianity is not really a religion, but a science, an objective, revelatory process, and an eye-opening journey of ongoing discovery. Its telling of culture's story from the point of view of the victim undoes myth and forces us to take a clearer view of things. We did not stop burning witches because we invented science, says Girard. We invented science because we stopped burning witches. Rather than pushing an arbitrary concession of free thought and free will to an otherworldly authority figure, the gospel ultimately undermines myth-making authorities. Christianity is the religion, which is the destroyer of religion. In a similar way, Girard argues that his own theories also belong to the realm of social science, to be tested or rejected as such. His central theories concern scapegoating, that is, we do not know how to be an us except over against a them, and what he calls mimetic theory, which proposes that our desires are not our own, but are always copied from other models, who tend to become rivals, who tend to become scapegoats. Such notions in and of themselves might not be a stumbling block to modern intellectuals, but Girard insists that he did not invent these theories so much as find them in the Bible. Scandal indeed. In this book, I won't be instructing on how to read Girard. Others have covered this better than I can. What I want to share, as one of his students, is how I read culture with my new Girardian glasses. Wearing these, I suddenly see my culture glowing with intricate and repeating patterns of light and darkness. I see new hopes and new dangers breaking ever more dramatically into a world where our old gods fail and flail, their violence ever more exposed, ever more revealed as a copy of the violence it opposes. The other day, I tried to explain to my teenage daughter the charges laid against Carlos Larmon, the first Canadian to be charged under a new law prohibiting travel for the purpose of joining in terrorist activity abroad. "Isn't that what soldiers do? Go overseas to fight in a war?" she asked. "The law is against the soldiers on their side, not the soldiers on our side," I told her. "You're right, they're similar, but you can't say that." "Why? What are they going to do? Send me to juvie?" "No, but you'll make people very angry." The morale of the campaign against terrorism depends on a clear moral distinction between their violence and ours. For on either side of the war on terror, there is a narrative about a people under attack. Each side perceives the other as an aggressive threat to its deepest values. The more one side defends itself, the more the other side perceives it as the aggressor. In this spiraling escalation, each side mirrors the other's violence. Yet the gods that once blessed our violence as heroic and cursed their violence as barbaric have been deposed. We cannot kill them all and let God sort them out, as we so enthusiastically did in the Crusades. We don't believe in that God anymore. So we find ourselves facing opponents who, as former Middle East correspondent Chris Hedges says, are willing to die in numbers we find unacceptable. The privilege of previous empires to establish peace by the total wipeout of threatening rivals is no longer available to the West. The Pax Americana teeters not only because its wars are becoming too expensive, but also because they are too repugnant to its citizens. Schizophrenically, we drop blankets one day and bombs the next, leaving it to the recipients of our strange mercy to discern the noble intent behind our drones, missiles, and fighter jets, and to forgive us the necessity of our collateral damages. The bodies of mothers, fathers, sons, and daughters strewn throughout their dusty villages and streets. The sacred aura of our violence now hangs on the narrative that we are not acting in the name of power, but in the name of the victim. In this sense, we are still crusaders, painting crosses on our soldiers' shields. We bombed Afghans to save their schoolgirls from the Taliban. We are bombing Syrians and Iraqis to save their religious minorities and our journalists from decapitation by jihadis. When we dismember and decapitate non-combatants, we want it counted as an oops, to preserve our supposed moral superiority to those who, in their reciprocating rage, do such things on purpose and on camera. Can't they see that our violence is messianic? Every soldier of the West today wants to be a son of David, to see ourselves as sons of Goliath would be our undoing, fatal to our morale. We are stunned when yet another Western-raised youth goes off to join the blind purity of ISIS holy war against us. We should consider that these young people are turning in disgust from the bald, unholy hypocrisy of our war against them. We are in a terrible new danger on this battlefield. Our violence is no longer transcendent. It has lost its sacred bloom. In a world where violent gods are exposed as frauds, the shape of a new hope looks, by my Girardian lights, a lot like the cover of the 5 million copy special edition of the satirical newspaper Charlie Hebdo that went viral. The first issue to be published after two gunmen stormed their Paris office and executed their editorial staff in retaliation for the newspaper's history of publishing cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad. The drawing shows the Prophet Muhammad with a tear in his eye, holding a sign that says, "Je suis Charlie." Beneath the drawing is the caption, "All is forgiven." Here, the man of God, wounded and weeping, identifies himself with the executed innocents, while at the same time proclaims total forgiveness. We have seen this prophet before. By creating yet another image of the Prophet Muhammad, the cartoonist defiantly carries on the distinctly Western satirical tradition that is sacred to him. A tradition that insists that nothing is sacred. And yet this cartoon also expresses the heartache and forgiveness of a determined truth-teller. Though it may be presented to us through the figure of Muhammad in the pages of an atheist newspaper, this image preaches Jesus' gospel in the public square more clearly than anything I have seen or heard for years. Monsieur Lousier, who escaped the massacre because he had overslept by half an hour, said that he cried after drawing this picture. We are cartoonists, and we like drawing little characters, just as we were as children. The terrorists, they were kids. They drew just like we did, just like all children do. At one point, they lost their sense of humor. At one point, they lost the soul of their child, which allowed them to look at the world with a certain distance. He added, "I'm sorry we've drawn him yet again, but the Muhammad we've drawn is just a little guy who's crying." Just a little guy who's crying. The shortest verse in all of Christian scripture is this: Jesus wept. Perhaps the collators of the New Testament gave this simple sentence a standalone status, because it by itself reveals more about the Son of God than reams of other writing. We've only just begun, as Slavoj Žižek says, to grasp the implications of a God who suffers. Other God-men in other sacred stories impress us with heroic, often violent feats, which turn out to be history rewritten according to the victors. Instead of the myth of the victors, Jesus gives us the truth of the victim, a truth that we can bear only through the love of the one who was offering it. Zineb al-Razoui, another surviving staffer of Charlie Hebdo, explained the headline, "All is Forgiven." "We feel, as the Charlie Hebdo team, the need to forgive the two terrorists who killed our colleagues. We cannot feel any hate toward them." With a mere cartoon, the surviving staff of Charlie Hebdo responded to the bullets that killed their colleagues by saying something principled and sincere. "Their hateless salvo gives me hope. For unlike most counter-terrorist measures, it is free of the old delusion the cross fatally undermines, the delusion of peace by the means of war. After the cross has done its work, the only means we have left is forgiveness." Even so, in publishing this cartoon, Charlie Hebdo risked a counter-escalation. Since many Muslims interpret Charlie Hebdo's voice through the long history of French colonial violence and hegemony, the eager shouts of "Je suis Charlie" that followed the massacre carried both good news and already a perversion of this goodness. On the one hand, there was an identification with the victim that really does spell progress. And on the other hand, a West is best rally, forgetful of its own patterns of victimage. When Marie Antoinette declared, "Let them eat cake," it was not exactly an act of violence, but it was an act of privilege and ignorance offensive enough to a starving and humiliated populace that it triggered the bloodiest uprising in European history. In the impoverished outskirts of Paris today, an alienated underclass of Muslims is one arrogant provocation away from riot. All over the world, there is unparalleled inequality, underneath which there is seething. It is a time for the privileged West to be humble and show grace. And grace is not yet grace when we are magnanimous from a position of power. Grace is grace when we can be kind, even when there is some of our own blood spilt in the street. It is a kind of craziness to confront angry assailants with forgiveness, but compared to the old craziness of killing people to show that killing people is wrong, it opens a door on the otherwise closed circle of vengeance. It is the kind of hopeful craziness worthy of that word I am so cautious of, but want to take back so badly. Faith. Jesus saw through the sacred lies that uphold human order, but somehow had the gall to tear the veil away from our sacrificial altars and the false peace they beget. Where did this confident clarity come from? Somehow Jesus knew a peace more real than the calm of effective social control. Somehow he was tapped into a divine reality more free of death than the one guarded so fearfully by religious authority. Somehow he was tied into a peace so external to the Pax Romana that he could transform its cross from a punitive, order-enforcing tool of the powers into a subversive and loving invitation to the lifeway of a disciple. As the implications of this feat continue to seep in, I can find no better words to express my awe than those of the Roman centurion who witnessed the crucifixion. Surely this man was the Son of God. My other crazy teacher after René Girard is a contrarian priest named Ivan Illich. Girard helped me to see the scapegoat and what it meant for Jesus to become the scapegoat to end all scapegoats. Illich has helped me to see the hero of one of Jesus' parables, the Samaritan, and his great leap out of the world of tribal ties into a completely free, rebellious friendship with a wounded foe, the beaten-up Jew in the ditch. He helped me see how wonderful such a friendship is. My friendships with those who are my other, queer folk, Muslims, refugees, atheists, these friendships are not anathemas, but God's great surprise, the pearl in the net, shimmering with rainbowed beauty, the place where I approach and encounter the other, who comes in the guise of the stranger. And such friendship is dangerous, according to Illich. Dangerous in that it is destructive to group identity, but also dangerous because it is prone to terrible perversions when institutionalized. In one of my previous careers, I was a mental health crisis worker, answering phones at the end of a suicide hotline and then driving the services van to people in crisis. We drove to homeless shelters, where Winnipeg's scarred and scary folk wolfed down donuts and soup in crowded halls smelling of urine and adorned with graphic photos of venereal disease. We also drove to some of Winnipeg's finest neighborhoods, where I sat in overstuffed chairs beneath chandeliers and vaulted ceilings as I ran through mental status exams. I met people with just about every classification in the DSM-IV, that list of recognizable mental afflictions that qualify a person for psychiatric intervention. But the one affliction I saw most often was one that is not, must not be, named in the DSM-4, because it is untreatable by institutional means. Loneliness. I met too many people who were really just looking for a friend, and who would manipulate the system, pulling whatever levers were at their disposal, including self-harm if need be, in order to trigger an interaction. I came to see these institutionally prescribed interactions as a perverse kind of pseudo-friendship, devoid of the honesty, freedom, and love that are the practices of any real friendship. A possibility that it was explicitly forbidden by protocol in the system of care. When I heard Illich explain the meaning of the Antichrist, a spirit that looks like the compassionate Christ but does the work of the devil, I recognized the dynamic in which we were caught. The wounded Jews in the streets of Winnipeg threatening suicide in order to force me to visit them as their obligatory paid Samaritan. I wanted out. By mathematizing, scaling up, and making more efficient the Samaritan's free, self-giving, and gracious response to the other, that system had become a prison for its, quote, clients and for its, quote, clinicians. This institutionalization of love has made us all safer, extending our lives and improving our meds, but was systematically corrosive of genuine community, real human love, and true freedom. Illich discerns in modern institutions of healthcare, schooling, government, etc., the vestiges of the Christian Church. He claims that these are not just leftovers, but corruptions of Christianity. The troubled legacy of Christendom, which modern institutions have inherited, he says, is the terrible perversion that comes of love and truth when these are underwritten by institutional power. Illich argues that first the Church, and after it modern institutions, succumbed to the hubris of believing, quote, that man can do what God cannot, namely, manipulate others into their own salvation. This hubris is at the root of the Church's evils, which disillusioned moderns can rehearse so well, the sins of patriarchy, of violent colonial proselytization, the attempts at total cultural control. All of these ills were undergirded by this belief that Christ's everlasting kingdom of justice, love, and peace could be brought about through conventional power politics. The trouble, Illich argues, is not with the kingdom of heaven, but with the idea that human beings can be induced into it by force. This is quite clear to us by now when we recall the abominable attempts to torture medieval citizens into right belief, but apparently not at all so clear when we consider, say, modern attempts to bomb foreign lands into freedom and democracy. Corruptio optimi quae est pessima is Illich's formula. The corruption of the best is the worst. Girard is at pains to show that the triumph of the cross, rightly understood, can never become a chauvinist triumphalism. Illich, with his formula, shows that the triumph of the cross, easily misunderstood, becomes the most chauvinist, most demonic triumphalism of all. Both are aware of Christianity's inherent corruptibility and its historic corruptions, and both point to iconoclastic mechanisms within Christianity that continually expose its corruptions to the light of painful truth, bearable only through grace, opening a path to new life, and, of course, also to new corruptions. Illich describes the uniquely Christian notion of reform as, quote, essential to the understanding of Western history, end quote. Girard points to the, quote, staggering historical and anthropological significance of the cross. For Girard, the cross not only signifies the specific instrument of Jesus' death, but all victims, whose cries demand to be heard in light of Jesus' passion, especially those who, like Jesus, were vilified, tortured, and killed by the authorities as blasphemers and transgressors. Thus does the cross keep smashing apart our cultural certainties and leading us into new, usually unflattering, self-discoveries. Thus is it akin to experimental method. Thus is it a science. It is by taking on the viewpoint of those it marginalizes that cross-formed culture comes to be accurately mapped and more justly remade. But every revelation shakes us, erodes our confidence in core institutions, and sends us off, yet again, in search of a more honest truth and a less violent togetherness. Recall the 1960s, and then the disillusionment that followed, until we arrive at our current state in the age of irony, when we are too scandal-sore to believe in anything anymore, except maybe very quietly and inwardly. Whatever hopes people have today seem to be secret hopes. No one wants to be proved a fool again. Our faith in much of what we once believed in is shaken or gone altogether. But this does not mean that we live in a post-Christian world. Rather, it is an apocalyptic world. Apocalypse, as both Illich and Girard point out, literally means a revealing. And as the apocalyptic literature of the New Testament suggests, a revealing that is highly destabilizing to the present order. We are living in times both more revealing and more unstable than they have ever been. In this sense, Illich believes, not triumphantly, but fearfully, that we are living in, quote, the most obviously Christian epoch, which might be quite close to the end of the world. The gospel contains a conception of human life, not a theology, says Simone Weil. She explains, if I light an electric torch at night out of doors, I don't judge its power by looking at the bulb, but by seeing how many things it lights up. The brightness of a source of light is appreciated by the illumination it projects upon non-luminous objects. The value of a religious, or more generally, spiritual way of life is appreciated by the amount of illumination thrown upon things of this world. Earthly things are the criterion of spiritual things. While I know that Christianity has become an anathema to many, and for many good reasons, I see things around me that I could not see otherwise because of the gospel. The religionless Christianity that Dietrich Bonhoeffer was just beginning to perceive in his final days in a Nazi jail is being born among us as Jesus, who is numbered with the transgressors, continues to tear down our impressive stony institutions and birth new, living, moving, fleshy communities where we will be surprised to sit at table with our enemies. At the same time, new, institutional perversions of this inclusivity continue to pop up, swapping sanitized universal care and rights for the messiness of real relationships among beloved sinners, to which the gospel continues to beckon. To Christians, I offer this collection of essays as an encouragement to see how far out ahead of us Jesus has gone into the world, working in mysterious ways. As his disciples, many of our teachers will have to be those who followed Jesus out of the church and into the world some time ago, who could no longer abide the narrowness of our love and the hypocrisy of our codes. Some will come from other traditions altogether, and have their own ancient wisdom to bring to bear. A new attentiveness to these outside perspectives is not a no to our beloved Jesus, but rather a more profound yes. To non-Christians, I offer this book not as a set of directions, but as a map of where you are. There are other maps, to be sure, highlighting other topographical features. My aim is not to be exhaustive, but helpfully accurate about real aspects of our shared terrain. I hope I can speak as a Christian about contemporary culture in terms that are at least recognizable to others, rather than offering spiritual gobbledygook. We don't have time for that. There are real treasures and real pitfalls to mark out here. Christianity, as a historical vector, is a cause of much that is good, even great, about our age. But it is also a cause of much that is less good, even dangerous and destructive, to paraphrase Charles Taylor's foreword to Illich's final opus. Something new entered the world with the birth of Christianity, a new kind of freedom, and a new kind of danger. Illich would even say, evil. Whether or not we celebrate this freedom as Christian, or discern this danger in religious terms, we need to understand it. If we do, both Illich and Girard will suggest that we will become aware, anthropologically and historically, of what a strange place we are in. A moment that is all at once revealing and bewildering, expectant and apocalyptic, opening wide the gates both to endless war and to abiding peace. It is a place to tread carefully, with eyes wide open. If we walk attentively here, we might even find the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. Quick now, here now, always. A condition of complete simplicity, costing not less than everything. And all shall be well, and all manner of thing shall be well. If we can hold ourselves open to the strange signs of our times, we might just discover, as T.S. Eliot perceived, that in this odd place, the distance between here, now, and the eternal is not more than a comma's breadth.